From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast that filter feeds on information like a sponge. I'm Michael Crosser. Next to me is Chad Tilburg. And today's title is A Deep Dive into Sponges. So today we're talking about cleaning products, I think.
Yeah, right. That's
no.
What we're talking about.
We have a special guest star today in the studio, Professor Jeremy Weiss, who is a specialist in biology. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike and Chad.
I think most people think of sponges now as the thing that we use to clean our dishes and stuff. Although those are mostly the fake ones, right? Those are not like actual sponges anymore.
Very few people use actual non-synthetic sponges in their kitchen.
Do you ever find pink and blue sponges in the wild?
I do actually find some pink and blue species.
Oh, that was a bad question on my part.
Yeah, yes. you thought you were being clever there, didn't you?
Thought you sent me out, but yeah, no.
Right.
Well, what is a sponge?
So a sponge is an animal, a very, very simple animal that lives under the sea, as SpongeBob correctly identified. And it's a filter feeder. So it pumps water through its body and removes little bacteria and other small things out of the water column and eats them. And that's about all it does.
Yeah. What do you mean by a very simple animal?
It has essentially no internal structures, right? So you think of a human, for example, right? We have lots of organs and systems and bones and muscles and all sorts of different tissue types. Sponges don't. They're really just essentially uniform throughout their body. So if I cut a piece off of a sponge, every piece looks essentially the same.
Okay. Do they not have tissues? Like you mentioned organ systems and things like that.
Technically, there are no tissues in a sponge.
Okay. What about, this is a multicellular animal.
It's a large, large multicellular animal.
Okay.
But I don't know how many different cell types humans have, but hundreds or thousands of cell types. I think sponges have like 4 or 5 different cell types.
Okay.
And that's it. So even the differences there are very, very minimal.
Okay. When did sponges come on the scene evolutionarily?
The first evidence in the fossil record is something like 600 to 650 million years ago. Really even before animals sort of exploded onto the planet.
So, I mean, what you're suggesting is they were around for a good 100 million years before most of the major modern body plans of animals that we're familiar with came on the scene.
Exactly.
Right.
So are you saying that's like they were some of the first animals then?
I am not saying they were some of the first animals. I'm actually saying that they were the first animals.
Okay. So did they break off from plants?
No, not at all.
Okay.
And that line gets kind of fuzzy between a multicellular protist and an animal, but the organism that made that transition is very likely the sponge. So the first thing that existed on the planet that we would classify as an animal.
Yeah, so if you were to jump back in a time machine back to when sponges were just coming onto the scene,
okay,
their closest relative would be something called a coanoflagellate, I believe.
Well, so then what is an animal then? Can we define what that means? Right, yeah. Because we're animals, but sponge is so different from what we do. Right? I mean,
so what do we have in common then? What do we have in common with a sponge?
I mean, the way I learned it is an animal is something that eats and moves.
But do sponges move?
Their larval stage moves, and that's true of lots of animals that have a non-moving adult stage, that they're still animals, but the movement only occurs in their larval stage. So yes, they can move around as larvae, and then they settle, and they don't move after that, as opposed to like a plant that just absorbs energy from the sun.
Okay. So larvae of sponges are able to move around.
Yes.
So are those the only two categories that they eat things and they...
Yeah. So, I mean, if you mentioned plants a little bit ago, and so one way to think about this is where are they getting their energy from and where are they getting their carbon source from?
Okay.
And one thing that distinguishes plants in a very important way is that plants are getting their carbon from capturing carbon dioxide. And they're getting their energy from the sun. And so all animals are unified by getting both their energy and their source of carbon by consuming other organic molecules.
Okay.
So all animals are consumers to some degree. We simply cannot make our own food.
Oh, good. Okay.
Right. Okay. And so the way that what distinguishes us from like fungi, for example, that also are consumers, right? They have to get their energy and carbon from some sort of external source. Is that animals digest those organic molecules inside their body in some way. They have some sort of digestive space or cavity in their body, whereas fungi do that externally. They excrete enzymes into the environment. It breaks down complex molecules, and then those broken down molecules are reabsorbed back into the fungal body. Okay, and so that, at a very basic level, I think that's what Jeremy's talking about in kind of like a more detailed way about they eat stuff, right? Yeah. So it's a very specific way of taking on board organic molecules that we use to build our bodies and to fund our cellular respiration.
Good. Okay.
And at some point, we have a motile stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is it that sponges eat then?
They eat plankton. Plankton are any number of microscopic things that live in the seawater. So bacteria that are plankton and other sort of small eukaryotic organisms hang out in the water column and generally don't move around a lot. They just move with the currents of the water.
Okay.
Right. So they're in the water. So a sponge creates a current inside its body and that sucks water into its body. And then that water gets routed into these little filtering chambers where all of the particles are captured and consumed. And the water gets pumped out and they've acquired enough energy that they can survive like that.
How are they sucking in water and plankton and so forth?
So in these little filtering chambers, there's a whole bunch of cells that have flagella, little tail-like projections that they whip back and forth, and it makes a water current. And their body is set up so that water gets sucked in and routes into these chambers.
So the water's kind of coming in through the side, right?
Generally speaking,
okay,
it's all along the sides of the organism.
Okay. And they tend to have like a large, really conspicuous opening at the top, but that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about all over the body.
Right. So the inhalant water is in what are generally pretty microscopic openings on all over the sides of their body. If you've seen a picture of a sponge, they all have that opening on the top. That's the exhalant water. Water that they have filtered comes out.
So all along the sides, there are these little flagella, these little tails that are kind of whipping water into.
Yeah, you could imagine like a little chamber and a whole bunch of little oars sticking into that chamber. And if they were all sort of moving in the same kind of way, it would create a situation where water is unidirectional.
Yeah.
And then there's some sort of like little straining apparatus that grabs onto or filters out or sticks to the microscopic.
Yes. So these cells that have the flagella, at the base of the flagella, there's a ring of like smaller hair-like projections that act as essentially as a net. And whatever gets caught in these cells, and then the cell can digest it, and all of that nutrients then gets shared throughout the organism.
Okay.
So it stands to reason that these cells have to be coordinating their activities. Is there anything known about how those collar cells, all that comprise a single chamber, are coordinating their activities in a way? I mean, is there some sort of cell-to-cell communication that must be going on?
There's some guy going, oh-ee-o.
Right, there's somebody with like a big drum somewhere.
Yeah,
that's good.
That is an excellent question. No, we have no idea. There is no nervous system, right? So in us, that coordination happens because we have a nervous system that tells the cells what to do. There is no nervous system. No one's ever found anything. But we have found sort of precursor parts to the nervous system. For example, all of our nerve cells have these ion channels, and we see very similar ion channels in lots of sponge cells with no idea why they're there. But everyone who works on that stuff says, this looks like precursor nervous system, and we know there's some kind of coordinated response in these cells. So somehow that must be allowing these cells to communicate. So yeah, there's got to be some kind of cell-to-cell communication, but we don't know how that works yet.
So you don't know if it's just an actual intentional thing or if it's just randomly there that weakly coupled systems will just kind of synchronize. Like if I had a wall of grandfather clocks, eventually they would all synchronize together.
Hold on a second. But then would they fall out of synchrony eventually? Because each pendulum is slightly different. So there'll be like a moment where they're all swinging together, but then...
So like good clocks where they all would have the same pendulum length because they're all keeping the same time. We're getting away from sponges here, but clocks, as you change the pendulum length is how you can define keeping a second, and so they all would be beating at the same rate, but you could start them at different times, but just by vibrations through the walls and stuff, eventually they would actually synchronize with each other. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a cool thing.
Well, no, I think this is an important point because it gets at the question of whether all of these collar cells are beating their flagella just without any sort of communication that's right. happening among the cells, or if you could actually identify sort of what Jeremy is talking about, these sort of ion channels that look very, I mean, structurally, they're like the same thing that we find in neurons, right?
Exactly the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly yeah. the same thing. And so mm-hmm. we know what they're doing in the cells in more complex animals. They're communicating. So
yeah, so then there's no brain. That would be the distinction, I guess.
Well, I'm not convinced you need a brain.
Okay.
You just need cells that can communicate.
Yeah. There are lots of things that don't have brains that still have precursor nervous systems. So you okay. don't need that. Okay, but you asked me, do I know? I don't know, but we do see other physical responses in some species of sponges. So a species that we work with, if you touch them, their oscula, that large central opening where they exhale water, will close. And the fact that that can constrict is impressive, especially for something that doesn't have any muscle tissue. But also, that's a unified kind of response. So if I touch like part of the sponge, pretty much anywhere I touch on the sponge, the oscula will close. So there's got to be some kind of communication system that exists in there. We just don't know what it is.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you this. So you just said something very interesting about they have the capacity for at least some sort of movement, right? I mean, they're not moving around the environment, right. but they can move certain parts of their body relative to each other.
Yes.
And most animals accomplish that by muscle contraction, but you just said that they don't have muscles. But do they have similar to kind of precursors to elements of a nervous system? Do they have precursors to elements of a musculature system?
My guess would be yes, but I don't know any literature. So
I mean, you would think it probably has something to do with actin filaments and
myosin.
I would think that there's some kind of actin and myosin filaments there interacting and contracting.
And the only reason I know the word myosin is because we've had an episode of Crisscrossing Science about myosin. I got a plug every time we do something
yeah.
like that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's enough of a back catalog now that.
Yes.
So.
So when you said at the very beginning that sponges are simple animals, you mean in the sense that they are precursors to much more complicated things. So you can kind of imagine how more complicated things would come from that. Because they've got motion in there, right? I mean, the flagella, the whipping oars or whatever.
Yeah.
That's not what we would call a muscle, but that is, I would imagine, that on the molecular scale, that is the same stuff happening to make it the whipping motion, I would guess.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So generally, it's just in the sponge, these things are happening on a sort of cell by cell basis. As animals got more and more complex, the systems evolved so that we could move bigger parts of ourselves all at once and, mm-hmm. you know, just have more complicated interactions with the environment.
Kind of the groundwork was there. And if you kind of know what you're looking at, you can see the precursors for things like neuron cells that communicate with each other or muscle mm-hmm. cells that move the body. What about, is there any sort of self-recognition or immune system in a sponge? Like if you were to do sort of an organ transplant, like take two sponges, cut them in half, and then slap them together, two different individuals, do they recognize self from non-self?
They absolutely do, actually. There's a really classic introductory biology lab experiment that you can do. You can take a sponge species and pass it through a filter so that you dissociate all of the cells and you end up with just like a pool of cells. And if you do that with two different individuals and mix them all together, they will self-sort. So like all of the cells from individual A will clump together and all of the cells from individual B will clump together and start to reassemble themselves.
That is crazy.
That is crazy. That's why sponges are awesome.
So would it? We've been talking a lot about like parents and, you know, reproduction and so forth in the last few episodes or so. Could you do that experiment with a parent sponge and a daughter sponge?
That's a good question. I'm sure you could. My bet is that they would not distinguish parent from daughter, that there's not enough genetic differences there. So generally when you do this experiment, you do it with two things of very different species. And so you can get a really nice distinction there because it's a red species and a blue species and they will sort themselves out.
Sure.
So since you brought it up, let's go there. What does sponge reproduction look like?
For lots of sponge species, we actually have no idea how they reproduce, but there's enough of them that we've studied it that we can probably make some guesses that things are reasonably uniform. Generally, these chambers that have these flagella, when the sponge is ready to reproduce, those chambers will go through some morphological changes, some shape changes, and they become like gamete-producing chambers. In some sponge species, there are male individuals and female individuals, and so they'll make male individuals will make sperm cells and then release them into the water, and female individuals will make egg cells and release them into the water.
Oh, so they release the eggs into the water as well.
So in some species, sperm and eggs both get released into the water, and you have fertilization that occurs in the water. In some species, the sperm get released into the water, the eggs stay in the parent, and when the sperm get filtered through the sponge, fertilization occurs within the essentially the mother, and then those larvae are made and the larvae get released into the water.
Okay.
It ends up being really, really variable across all of sponges.
Is it possible that some of them are exclusively asexual?
It's certainly possible. It doesn't seem likely if we look at genetics that looks like sexually reproducing kinds of things.
I see.
And so how do you know it looks like that? It's just that there are enough variation within a...
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. Sort of like paternity test in a legal proceeding or something, I assume, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We can look at levels of variation, and right, we don't see much clonal organisms spread throughout an environment. So
okay.
That does happen occasionally, too. If a piece of a sponge breaks off in a storm or something like that, that piece might resettle and reattach someplace else. And right, those will all then be genetically identical. But we can look at populations as a whole, and there's lots of genetic differences there.
Okay.
So what are sponges doing in the environment?
All that they're doing is filter feeding. When we say that, that seems like not a big deal, but it ends up being really, really important for the environments in which they live. One big role that they play is cleaning the water column. So, right, if you pump lots and lots of water through yourself and remove things from it, then you're helping to keep the water a lot clearer. Okay, so who cares, except that all of the plants and other photosynthetic organisms that, say, live on the bottom need really clear water so you can get light penetrating all the way down to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen in examples of when sponge die-offs have occurred that the water gets really murky and all of, say, the seagrass dies.
Hmm. What kind of other interactions do they have? I mean, are they, is anything eating them? Are they interacting with other kinds of organisms in any way?
There's a few organisms that will eat sponges. They tend to not be all that nutritious, so there's not a lot of things that will eat them. There's a couple species of fish that will eat them. There's some turtles. Largely, all of their sort of ecological interactions are happening with microorganisms. So we talked about that they're feeding on bacteria and other microorganisms, but they also live symbiotically with huge, huge communities of microorganisms. So within their tissues, there are lots of bacteria and viruses and fungi that just live there and are not being eaten.
And what are they doing there?
That is kind of the million-dollar question of my research.
Oh, so that is your actual research then?
So, yeah, I work on interactions between microorganisms, mostly bacteria, and sponges. When we look at these communities, just the bacteria alone, it's not uncommon to find 700 or 900 species of bacteria that live within an individual sponge.
Whoa.
So how do we figure out what they're doing? It's going to take us a lot of time to answer that question. Sponge microbiology people like myself have looked at these things, and a species, generally speaking, has sort of a core microbiome, right? A core community of microbes that lives with them, meaning a set of species that we find consistently whenever we look at individuals of that species. Then they'll also have a much more variable part of their microbiome that can vary from individual to individual, from habitat to habitat. So some of those things then are probably obligate. We don't find them really in the water column. We only find them living in sponges. What they're doing for the sponge as a host is still unknown. There are some sponge diseases, but not very many of them. So they're probably not pathogens, whether they're mutualists, whether they're helping the sponge, or whether they're commensals and just sort of benign hanging out. Largely, we don't know.
And so what kinds of things might they be doing, and how would you test that?
So we have a couple examples where we do know. There are a couple of examples of photosynthetic microorganisms that live in the sponge, and those photosynthetic organisms are feeding the sponge.
Well, all right, so obligate, what does that mean?
So obligate means that they have to be there. There are some bacteria, for example, that we only find living in the sponge, which suggests to us that they cannot survive outside the sponge. They have to survive in the sponge.
But they have to swim, or they have to move around in order to get to a new sponge.
They don't, because they actually end up colonizing the larvae before it leaves the host.
Ah, clever. All right.
These symbionts get passed from parent to offspring. They colonize the larvae or colonize an egg before they leave the mother.
Okay.
And you can look at the microbiome, the microbial community in the parent and in the larvae and in the juvenile stage and see that some aspects of it are identical.
So you're giving examples of all symbiotic relationships. And so you said like mutual, which would be, it's helping the bacteria and it's helping the sponge.
Right. So you said mutualist, right? Everybody benefits. Commensal is an interaction where one organism benefits, the other organism doesn't benefit, or no harm or benefit.
Okay.
And then a parasite would be an interaction where one organism gains and the other organism loses. So a pathogen, right? A disease-causing organism is a parasite.
It's a parasite. Okay.
We see probably all of those kind of interactions. They're living in this structure, right? And the sponge acts as a sort of scaffolding for them, and they can hold on to that scaffold, and the sponge then moves water by them continuously. And that's like a great environment for bacteria. So you're someplace safe and nothing's really going to eat you, and there's a constant supply of nutrient-rich water that moves past you. A couple examples of sponge diseases, and so some of these things are probably parasites. A whole big swath in the middle are probably commensals. They're living in the sponge, they're benefiting by being there, access to food in a very controlled environment, but the sponge doesn't really care. And then another subset that are mutualists that are helping out the sponge.
So I've heard it said before, and I'm just going to assume it's true because I've heard it said, that on the human body there are more bacteria cells than there are human body cells.
That is true, yes.
Is the same thing true for the sponges?
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean they're mostly bacteria on a cell-to-cell basis, right?
Yeah.
And so I like that analogy that you just mentioned, that they're kind of like this scaffold. It just makes me think of it's a bacteria's world, really. And all this animal tissue is just sort of like the stuff they're living in.
So you're saying then that bacteria, wait, on us or in us?
Both.
Both.
Okay. That we are made up more of bacteria than we are of our own selves.
If you were to count up the Michael Crosser cells.
Yes.
And you count up the bacteria cells on Michael Crosser.
Yeah.
There would be more bacteria cells.
Hmm.
It's important. It's not by weight, right?
No.
There's more mass of Crosser cells than there are bacterial cells.
What are you saying?
But by number alone, and also importantly by like number of genes, there's way more bacteria on you than there are of you, right? Way more bacterial cells than there are.
So you're saying like bacteria cells are generally smaller than my cells would be?
Vastly.
Vastly smaller.
Ah, so you could, on every one of my cells, you could have 10 bacteria cells just kind of hanging out on the surface or something like that.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So then that's not as, I mean, that still sounds crazy to me, but.
But you're just carpeted in this stuff. You are carpeted in bacteria.
Yeah.
And so these sponges, I mean, because they're so porous, not only are they carpeted kind of on the outside, but every single one of those tiny little channels, if you think about a sponge, is just like carpeted with these bacteria.
Mm.
And it really is. It really is billions. Like we estimate 100 million cells per like gram of sponge tissue. So.
That's why I said it's a bacteria's world and we're just living in it.
But so then how can you do like DNA testing if...
That's a good question.
If you've got all this other garbage all over the place then.
Not garbage.
How dare you?
All the important things. Because the sponge DNA is still different from the bacterial DNA, right? We can distinguish sponge DNA from bacterial DNA.
Okay.
Well, and again, since largely I work on the bacteria, not the sponges, it's the sponge DNA that's the garbage for me. So
I love that. Like he's like, you know, I study sponges, and now he's totally dissing on sponges. It's like, actually, I'm really interested in the bacteria.
I see.
He has to like say he's a sponge biologist because sponges are far more charismatic than bacteria.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't have invited me on if I was just talking about bacteria all the time.
Yeah. So. Uh-uh.
Yeah. That's true. I'm glad we got that settled. That's good.
So I want to get back to some of the ecology of sponges. Okay. And are there any conservation considerations related to sponges? What can we learn from them about, I don't know, environmental health?
So generally speaking, actually, when environments degrade, the sponges actually end up coming in. Like, you know, they'll exist in low numbers in a, say, on a coral reef. But when that coral reef degrades and the corals die, that reef becomes really sponge dominated. So there's not conservation concerns in that there's essentially no sponges that are at risk of extinction, but the sponges end up being really good indicators of ecosystem health.
So they will, they're sort of like the cockroach of the sea. That's
not very generous.
I prefer canary in the coal mine as an analogy, but yes.
But like bad things happen and then they're like, oh, now I can spread out and I can do my own thing.
Yes. right? Because as water quality deteriorates, that can be a problem for lots of organisms. But for a sponge that's wants really nutrient-rich water, it ends up being beneficial. So we get more and more sponges there, and we can use those sponges to get a sense for how healthy an environment is. I said coral reefs as an example, but I've done work on the Oregon coast as well to sort of look at, okay, how does the sponge community change as nutrient pollution changes as it comes in and goes away? And we do see shifts in sponge communities, and we see shifts in the microbial community within the sponge as the nutrient levels change.
So do things like runoff that are coming down the watershed influence what the sponges are doing or experiencing?
Very much so. Right. And again, it's not necessarily that the sponges won't like it. It's that, you know, we might see shifts in what sponges are present, and we'll see changes in what bacteria live within them.
So I seem to remember hearing something about one of your field sites in Florida, you kind of capturing in real time or pre and post a hurricane. Is that, am I remembering that correctly?
There was a hurricane that went over one of our field sites in Florida.
Yeah. And
we've looked at some of that. We have been doing some work in the Florida Keys. So, right, island chain off of the southern tip of the Florida Peninsula. And it's, our sites are in the lower Keys. So this is about 20 miles up from Key West. So really kind of out in the middle of open ocean. And I've been working in there for many years, but Hurricane Irene passed, the eye of the hurricane passed about 2 miles from our field site.
Not while you were there?
Not while we were there, like a month after we had left.
Oh, okay.
But if you know anything about hurricanes, right, the eye is really not the dangerous part. It's like
right near it.
50-mile-wide storm. So it got Category 4 level winds that passed over our field sites. So we've been back since then, and there definitely are changes in what sponge species survived and what didn't. And largely we think that's sponges that are sort of have lower profiles in the water did fairly well. Sponges that are more upright and stick up from the bottom more just got ripped off the bottom.
Because they were getting thrashed around by all the wave action or something?
Exactly.
Right. Oh, I see.
Right.
That makes sense.
That's definitely one place where we've seen sort of ecological changes in the sponge community in response to shifts. But we've also seen shifts in Oregon. The whole West Coast was hit by sea star wasting disease a couple years ago. And that...
What does that mean?
Pause.
No, it's still recording. What is that?
I know you're pausing.
So you know what sea stars are.
What normal people would call starfish, but yes, they're now called sea stars.
Sorry. Sea star wasting disease is a disease. We think it's viral that killed in some places like 90% of the sea stars, of the starfish.
Okay.
Sea stars in these environments, they're sort of the top predator in the environment, and they shape the rest of the community. So when the sea stars got essentially wiped out, the community shifted a lot, and people are still tracking this, but at one of our field sites on the Oregon coast, the sponges essentially disappeared.
So I'm confused. I thought you were just telling us that if things die off, then the sponges are able to kind of swoop in and take over.
Nothing is absolute in biology.
Right. Well, there's that. It might be that the sea stars no longer being there released some sort of really strong competitor with the sponges. And so now something that perhaps had been kept in check by the sea stars no longer has that herbivore that's eating it. And so, so there are all kinds of reasons why the food web dynamics might have changed.
We saw big increases in barnacles at our site. And my guess is that the barnacles outcompeted the sponges.
Okay.
Again, I don't know. It's only observations, but...
Right, and so you're saying sea stars would... Maybe the sea stars were eating the barnacles before.
They ate some of the barnacles.
And they didn't care so much for the sponges.
Right.
And then with them gone, then the barnacles just go crazy.
Perhaps.
So what's the take-home message about sponges?
Oh, okay. My take-home message about sponges. So when I give talks, I tell students and or whatever audiences I'm in that I really want them to know that sponges are awesome, which is not like a big scientific thing, but... We started off and talked about how simple they were, and yet they really play a really important role in the environment and their ecosystems, and studying them tells us a lot about how animals came to be. And I think there's a lot of potential to sort of learn about these things in a sponge system than there are versus in the human system.
Well, thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jeremy.
This episode was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rudy Ortega wrote our theme music. Like us on Facebook to see pictures and see other content that we might find interesting. Subscribe to this podcast, and you will download the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, leave a comment and a rating. That will help other people find our podcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.